KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Joe Biden on Thursday addressed staff at the United States State Department, an agency that, like others under the Trump administration, was left demoralized and understaffed. Speaking directly to State Department employees, Biden promised to restore America's reputation globally.
You are the center of all that I intend to do. You are the heart of it. We're going to rebuild our alliances. We're going to re-engage the world and take on the enormous challenges we face, dealing with the pandemic, dealing with global warming, and again, standing up for democracy and human rights around the world.
Biden's speech was given on the heels of a major foreign policy decision to end U.S. support for the devastating Saudi war in Yemen. Biden is not known for being dovish, but he knows there remains little appetite for new or old wars among Americans. My guest is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, Corey.
I'm so glad to be here, Sonali.
So as I mentioned, Biden is certainly not somebody whose past reflects an attitude that prefers peacetime to wartime, although his experience with his own son being a casualty of a U.S. war has, you know, sometimes caused him to reflect more on war. But first, let's start with what you think specifically is going to happen on Yemen. This is a war that the U.S. has directly aided the Saudis with in terms of weapons and advice. And right before he left office, Donald Trump declared the Houthi rebels in Yemen to be a terrorist organization. So what has Biden done?
Right. Well, there are two things that have happened since Biden took office, and both are quite significant when we talk about actually ending the war on Yemen. The first is that there is a weapons deal that was negotiated with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in the last days of the Trump administration. And that weapon, when the United States sells weapons, this is usually brokered by the Defense Department and by the embassy in whatever country is the weapons are being sold to, but it has to be approved by multiple offices in Washington. The Congress has to sign off on it. The State Department has to sign off on it. A number of departments do. And so the Biden administration froze this deal, saying, we're going to review this. We're not just going to let it sail through. You might imagine, your viewers might imagine, that the U.S. has quite a well-oiled machine when it comes to selling weapons to countries around the world. And so it's quite used to these deals just sailing through. And the fact that Biden pressed pause and said, we're going to hold off on this, we're going to review it, is significant. The second thing, of course, is the announcement during Biden's speech at the State Department that the United States would end support for Saudi offensive operations in Yemen. Now, this is also very significant. It is, on one hand, it must be said that the level of suffering is really hard to appreciate what people have suffered in Yemen. The hundreds of thousands killed, the millions displaced, the many made sick, first with cholera and now more recently with COVID, though the cholera outbreak is ongoing. The many, many public health crises that are overlapping continue in Yemen. It's an absolute catastrophe, as the United Nations has said. It's called it the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. And so this suffering went on for many years, as you pointed out, with tremendous support from the United States. The United States would sell the weapons to Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the other their allies. The United States would offer logistics, such as the refueling of aircraft, which the United States also sold to Saudi Arabia. The United States would offer intelligence, that is, the targets that were actually attacked by Saudi Arabia were offered by the U.S. And so, in many ways, the U.S., when it comes to those operations, was doing everything except pulling the trigger itself. For Biden to say that this is actually going to stop, that we're no longer going to offer the support, is a very big deal. And it is the result, as you point out, not of any dovishness in Biden, but rather really tireless work by Yemeni activists and their supporters.
And there's also a tremendous bipartisan support for ending this war in Congress. And you know, so it was sort of an easy thing for Biden to take on as the first foreign policy issue. It would have been politically quite short-sighted of him to decide to continue the war, because the House and the Senate last year passed a bill that would have ended U.S. support for the Saudi war, except Donald Trump, who claimed that he was all about being, ending U.S. wars, vetoed that resolution. So that was quite significant that there is this support in both parties to end this the U.S. involvement in this war, right?
Yeah, it is. I think that's for a number of reasons. But one thing that must be said is that Trump's support of Saudi Arabia, look, the United States is a longstanding support of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia's human rights abuses are not something that is new. Those two are longstanding. And of course, you can go down the line of the various regimes in the Middle East that the United States supports enthusiastically, from Israel to the UAE to Egypt, et cetera, et cetera. This kind of thing has been longstanding policy on the part of the United States. What Trump did in his support of Saudi Arabia in particular, he was so crude, thuggish, that not only as Saudi Arabia was carrying out crimes for the whole world to see, such as the bombing of a school bus in Yemen a couple of years ago, when Saudi Arabia also was brutally repressing dissidents, as with the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, that, again, the whole world saw and knew about. When asked about this, Trump said, well, they buy a lot of weapons from us. Now, that
he just came and said the quiet part out loud.
Exactly. And so this isn't a secret, that the United States supports this kind of thing. But there are certain sensibilities to it that Trump upset. And I think that there is an appetite on the part of people in Congress and on the part of this administration to distance themselves from such a crude approach to U.S. power in the world that has open contempt for things like international law and human rights, which the United States wants to be the arbiter of. That is the meaning when Biden says America is back, which he said twice during his speech at the State Department.
And Josh, just for a minute to sort of focus on the tone of the speech, from reading the transcript of his speech, he seemed to signal that he wasn't going to use the sort of American exceptionalist rhetoric that even Obama engaged in, that maybe, far too many people see too much hypocrisy in that. So he sort of talked about rebuilding alliances, and many have drawn a contrast between the new state secretary, Antony Blinken, who is, at least on the surface, appears to be a sort of more modest, humble person, compared to his predecessor, Michael Pompeo, who brought what many considered to be this sort of swagger, this MAGA-style swagger to the State Department, much to the chagrin of diplomats who found that you can, catch more flies with honey, I suppose. But again, this is all sort of superficial, because we know overall, unfortunately, whether it's been under Democrats or Republicans, the U.S. has tended to enjoy starting wars and sustaining them. So right. Rather than the appearance, let's talk about the substance of it. Is Biden actually going to end, say, or link U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia on its human rights record?
So these are the important questions. And even when we're talking, if I could comment on Yemen first and then mm-hmm. maybe make a broader point. When we're talking about these operations in Yemen, as Shireen Al-Ademi, the Yemeni scholar and activist who is, among others, worked tirelessly for this kind of result, as she pointed out, the details of what the United States means when it says, we will stop support for offensive operations in Yemen those details really matter when we're talking about the lives of people in Yemen. So stopping support for offensive operations, does that mean that operations that Saudi Arabia declares are defensive are okay for the United States to support? Of course, there are all kinds of things that are justified in the name of defense. The United States war operation is run out of something called the Department of Defense, which carries out lots of offensive things in the name of defense. So that's really important question. Will the designation of the Houthis as a terrorist organization change? That really matters as well, considering the U.S. continues to carry out its own counterterror operations. And that's another point, is that the United States actually has had separate operations of its own, separate from those by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, going back to at least 2002, that were meant to supposedly fight al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, these so-called counter-terror operations. Now, when asked directly about the question of whether those operations would stop, Antony Blinken said, no, this is not about U.S. operations, counter-terror operations. This is about support for Saudi operations. So what does that mean? Because the United States operations are also part of the problem. And moreover, if the U.S. claims to continue to be fighting this war on terror in Yemen, then that very easily slips into support for other allied states that claim to be doing the same thing. So these details really matter. The bigger point that you're getting at, will this be a change of just style and not substance? I think is absolutely critical. Now, on one hand, there are some differences in terms of how Trump pursued U.S. power on the world versus how Biden wants to do it. I mean, Trump, again, showed utter contempt, not only for international law, but really any kind of multilateral agreements, trade deals. We know that he railed against things like NAFTA. He was against the FTAA, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He was critical of NATO. You know, all of these kind of multilateral alliances Trump was against, and instead wanted to negotiate bilaterally U.S. relations with various countries around the world and say, look, it's America first. We're not interested in the kind of international human rights regime. Biden has a different perspective, and it's the perspective that, frankly, is more in line with how the U.S. has ruled for the past, seven decades since World War II, where, again, as Biden puts it, the U.S. is at the head of the table, a kind of table of an international community. Now, does that mean less violence? Well, actually, just last week, the United States carried out an assassination in Iraq, assassinating of ISIS. And so the counter-terror operations continue. In the same speech at the State Department, Biden said that the United States would pause a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Germany, which was something that Trump had been talking about. And Biden said, wait a minute, we're going to hold off on that. The same week as the announcement at the State Department, the United States is carrying out exercises with allies, war games in Europe that are very much directed at Russia. So, yes, there are differences in terms of style from Trump to Biden, and there are some strategic differences as well. And, part of this is Biden trying to get the U.S.'s house in order for what they see as more serious enemies like Russia and China. And we have to be really careful. Yes, we should celebrate this big milestone regarding the U.S. in Yemen, but we can't accept that to say, we can't say, well, it's okay if the U.S. pulls back with operations in Yemen so they can focus on China. That's not what we're for. That's not an anti-war position.
Right. And it's been really interesting to see just in the first few weeks of the Biden administration, the fixation on Russia and the protests over the jailing of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny. And, you know, on the upside, at least, the U.S. did sign with Russia an agreement to extend the last remaining nuclear treaty, you know, after Trump canceled two nuclear treaties with Russia. So sort of mixed bag there on Russia. Let's talk about Iran and Afghanistan. Actually, first Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history. Joe Biden was part of the Obama administration that, you know, basically had terrible missteps on the Afghanistan war, increased troops there to no avail. And Trump talked about ending that war, in fact, tried to reduce and did, I think, succeed in reducing to a small number U.S. troops from Afghanistan right before he left. I mean, it seems, you know, Biden's foreign policy, one would hope, wouldn't just be about let's do the opposite of what Trump did, which, you know, if he chose to extend the war in Afghanistan, but ends U.S. involvement in Yemen, then it's just following a pattern of let's just do the opposite of Trump. What do you think will happen in Afghanistan?
Well, it's a good question. And the, you know, again, Biden and Trump, there are some differences in terms of style. There are some differences that they have in terms of who exactly they identify as enemies of the U.S. to be countered militarily. But there's quite a lot of agreement. And I think that when it comes to, I think that everybody knows that Trump is not somebody who is some lover of peace and wants, you know, a peaceful future for Afghanistan, or various other places where he talked about scaling down or repositioning U.S. troops. This was about a tactical decision to focus on China, which, I mean, Trump famously, crudely talked about China as being the enemy. And frankly, it's not terribly different. There's real continuity, actually, across several administrations, not just Trump and now Biden, but previous administrations as well, Obama and Bush, when it comes to identifying China's rise as this problem for the United States to contain and to deal with militarily. And so the idea that the U.S. should kind of cut its losses in Afghanistan to focus elsewhere, I think in a lot of ways has guided the decisions in Afghanistan. Now, that said, a key part of the strategy that the U.S. has had in Afghanistan, and again, this did not start with Trump, it goes back to Obama, is training Afghan forces to essentially play the role that the United States would play, but without U.S. Ground forces. Now, what are those Afghan forces doing? They're actually carrying out horrific human rights abuses and all kinds of massacres. There's tremendous civilian casualties in Afghanistan as a result of this U.S.-backed Afghan government and military. And actually, there's been some important reporting in The Intercept and elsewhere that points out that there are these death squads that the U.S. has been part of training on the part of Afghan forces. And so, you know, the hope is that the U.S. will withdraw from Afghanistan. We need to continue to push for a U.S. withdrawal. But the U.S. is also laying the basis for abuses to continue even as the number of U.S. troops scales down. So it's really important for us to pay attention to that as well.
So when we talk about how the Biden administration is going to pursue its foreign policy, it sounds as though he's basically suggesting we're going to return to normal, this sort of soft, I forget the term that had been used, soft power, there you go, which includes, for example, rebuilding alliances with Europe. This was something much to the, you know, dismay of our European allies. Trump basically said, we don't need NATO, we don't need our European allies, with the exception of the UK. It seems as though that kind of U.S.-Europe joint ventures into nations like Afghanistan, or together maybe holding countries like Iran accountable, is the place that a Biden-type figure is comfortable. Now, that may be preferable to the way in which Trump sort of ran roughshod through a lot of things, but we should certainly demand more, right? Let's talk about Iran. One of the few positive things that came out of the Obama administration in terms of the nuclear agreement, Iran seems eager to resume that agreement. What do you think the U.S. will do there on under Biden on Iran? It unfortunately isn't just a matter of, you know, putting the genie back in the bottle, I think.
Right. So this it remains an open question, because on one hand, it's true that the Iran nuclear deal was the signature foreign policy initiative of the Obama administration. It's something that Obama and Biden take a great deal of pride in. And there are certainly problems with it, and there are critiques to be had, not the least of which is that, you know, the United States, kind of as the arbiter of who gets to have nuclear weapons, is a problem. You know, the kind of sanctions regime that the US has had and continues to have on Iran, you know, there needs to be a real reckoning with that beyond just the deal. But the deal would be a very significant, it'd be very significant if the US actually returns to the deal. It moves in a good direction. However, it's actually unclear what exactly the Biden administration will do regarding the deal. Whereas initially there was a kind of sense that the Biden too would be eager to return to it, his officials who he's actually appointed have been a bit more reticent. And so Avril Haines, the new director of intelligence, during her confirmation hearings, when asked about the Iran nuclear deal, she said, well, we will be happy to rejoin it once Iran meets certain obligations, but we're far away from that right now. And actually, Antony Blinken said the same thing on the same day. And so there appears to be a more hesitance on the part of Biden administration officials to actually just rejoin the deal. And in the meantime, the sanctions continue on Iran. It also has to be said that the US's key ally, Israel, who opposed the Iran deal from the start, Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, famously came to Washington to address a joint session of Congress and chastise Obama for negotiating the Iran deal, which is quite a striking chapter in the history of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Israel continues to oppose the U.S.'s return to the Iran nuclear deal. And Biden administration has said, well, we will listen to Israel when it comes to our policy toward Iran. So what exactly that means, I think has yet to shake out. But I think that it points to the need for those of us who have been calling attention to the damaging impact of US sanctions on Iran and all the other incredible acts of belligerence that the US has had for a long time against Iran, but particularly under Trump, under what he called his maximum pressure campaign, parking an aircraft carrier off the coast of Iran for a full year, seizing Iranian oil tankers, carrying out military operations that, according to Trump, were within 10 minutes of bombing Iran. These kinds of things have to be reckoned with, and those of us who have been calling attention to this need to continue to push. We should not assume that simply because Biden has taken office that all of that will disappear.
Corey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future as Biden's foreign policy continues to be unveiled. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Smiley.
My guest has been Corey Peterson-Smith. He's a Middle East fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing what President Biden has revealed so far about his foreign policy. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at Rising Up at Sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.